the economic and business case for doing demand response is blindingly obvious. It's a much lower cost way of providing sometimes a higher quality service than a generator could. P415 is a modification that I proposed because somebody had to, and it was to fill in a gap in the access of independent aggregators to the different markets in GB. Every customer has a relationship with an energy supplier, but they buy their energy from them, they're billed for everything. In principle, that supplier should have every incentive to be really intelligent about using all possible flexibility that that customer might have. In practice, that doesn't really happen. You know, the business of being a supplier is quite different to the business of specializing in flexibility. You get lots of activity in terms of flexibility when you allow someone other than the supplier to do it.
The introduction of balancing settlement code modification P415 will open up the wholesale markets to demand response participants, allowing flexible consumers to gain value from their actions via a third party if their licensed supplier doesn't provide the service. In today's episode, Paul Troughton, Senior Director of Regulatory Affairs at NLX, joins Ed Porter to discuss the code change that he put forward that would allow increased consumer participation. If you're enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode and give us a rating wherever you listen. Let's jump in.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Transmission. Today I'm joined by Paul from NLX. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you for having me.
And as ever, we'd like to start off with just a little bit of your background. So who are you? What do you do for NLX? And perhaps what have you done in the energy space in the past?
I'm an engineer by background. I've been doing things to do with demand response since 2007. I started in a demand response aggregator startup in Melbourne in Australia, possibly one of the first. And they were kind of building the minimum viable virtual power plant. So very hands-on in a very small company. And that company was eventually acquired by Enernoc, which was a large American demand response aggregator. And then that was acquired by the Enel Group to make part of NLX. So now the world's largest demand response aggregator with a little bit under 10 gigawatts of dispatchable demand response from commercial industrial customers in 16 countries around the world, I think. So that's what the business does. It's part of the Italian Enel Group, which is a multinational utility. It's got, you know, 65 gigawatts of renewable generation. It's got distribution businesses and so on. But NLX is the sort of customer-focused part. So it's got the demand response and various other customer-focused things, not sort of classic utility things. In the UK, we're mostly an aggregator of commercial industrial demand response. My job, I kind of have two hats, one of which is in UK and Ireland doing regulatory affairs. So that's looking at market design issues and rule changes and trying to make things work better or stop things being made worse. My other hat is heading our Global Flexibility Policy Center, which is a very grand name for two people, but essentially we're supporting our colleagues in 19 countries who, you know, have relationships with policymakers and system operators, but maybe aren't fully across all of the issues around flexibility. We're trying to take lessons learned in one country and apply them in others, which is a really interesting, if somewhat confusing, role.
Yeah. Okay. No, super interesting. And I think a lot of people listening to this always like to hone in on kind of why something started and what and the kind of story behind where did it first take place. And so I like that piece around early in the sort of 2000s, you were in Melbourne looking at this. Why do you think that the kind of Australian market was ahead of others looking at this? And why do you think kind of Melbourne was that hotspot?
So it had been a liberalized market for quite a few years then. The national electricity market in Australia was set up in, I think, 1997. It's being a very transparent, real-time market means that it's very easy to understand. Well, easy is probably overstating it, but you can figure out what's going on and you can figure out the value of flexibility. The other thing is just the fundamental characteristics of that power system. Yeah, even before they added lots of renewables, it was a very peaky power system driven by hot weather spikes, basically. So there were some periods in which there was huge amounts of value from being able to move demand around, either system value or market value. The company started with an emergency program from the system operator for a particularly hot summer. And then we tried to figure out, well, we've done that. What other things can we do which are more sustainable? And that's how we got into the capacity market in Western Australia and providing fast frequency response, first of all in New Zealand, then in Australia. And in all those cases, you know, the economic and business case for doing demand response is blindingly obvious, that it's a much lower cost way of providing sometimes a higher quality service than a generator could. But the challenge is that the market's been set up around a few centralized power stations, not around these aggregations of small resources. So there's a lot of work you need to do to convince people to make the changes that are needed so that you can get access to the money that would otherwise be going to generators.
Yeah, and there's so much actually in there around a blueprint for bringing in more flexibility. And I think the things that I really like, so I really like that point around transparency of pricing. So once you kind of have that availability, you can get entrepreneurial spirits kind of coming in and looking at it and saying, do I want to do this? You also mentioned kind of there being system stress events. Mm. And actually system stress events almost make people think, okay, well, how can we do this differently? And we kind of saw it in the UK in COVID times where we wanted to turn down demand in certain locations because we had excess solar coming online. And you kind of see grids thinking about how to do things in a kind of more entrepreneurial or lower cost way. So I kind of really like that example of Australia. But we're not here to talk about Australia, even though we probably could and it would be fun. We're here to talk about P415. So what is P415?
So P415 is a proposal to change the balancing and settlement code. They are sequentially numbered. So it's the 415th one that's happened since it was set up. No significance to the numbers, really. The balancing and settlement code is the set of rules by which all of the participants in the electricity market play, basically. So it decides who's responsible for the volumes measured by each meter. So, and that's how you get paid for generation. You pay for the energy you're consuming. It's how the system operator can tell you to do things to help improve the balance. It's how you get punished for being out of balance. It gives you the incentives to do your wholesale market trades. That's the heart of the system, really. P415 is a modification that I proposed because somebody had to, and it was to fill in a gap in the access of independent aggregators to the different markets in GB. I should probably talk about independent aggregators. So every customer has a relationship with an energy supplier, but they buy their energy from them, they're billed for everything. In principle, that supplier should have every incentive to be really intelligent about using all possible flexibility that that customer might have in order to supply them at lower cost and more efficiently, to help them with the sort of cutthroat competition between suppliers. In practice, that doesn't really happen. The competition perhaps is not quite that cutthroat. Or another way of thinking about it is that, you know, the business of being a supplier is quite different to the business of specializing in flexibility. And there's not many examples of businesses that do both well. But the result of this is that it's just looking at history, you get lots of activity in terms of flexibility when you allow someone other than the supplier to do it. So the customer can stick with their existing supplier and get someone else to manage their flexibility. Now, GB's been really good for that in terms of having the capacity market and various ancillary services markets where you could work with whoever you wanted to get some value for your flexibility. The missing piece was wholesale market access. So before P415, if you wanted to get some value for your flexibility, some wholesale market value, then your only options were to work with your supplier if they were sufficiently enlightened to do that, or to say to your supplier, I just want to buy everything at wholesale prices, you know, charge me the day ahead price for everything, and then I'll manage things myself. That would work, but it requires the customer to be quite risk tolerant. And, you know, the fundamental thing about demand-side flexibility is that customers are not in business to do demand-side flexibility. They want an easy life doing something which potentially exposes them to lots of risks and certainly lots of complexity. It's not something that many people are going to volunteer for. So what P415 does is allows independent aggregators, which are called virtual trading parties in that particular role, to work with customers to get value for their flexibility from the wholesale market without any interaction with their normal relationship with their supplier.
So if I'm a consumer and I have flexibility on my site, I might both be able to have a relationship with my existing supplier, who might go about their business of being a very good supplier, and I might also have a relationship with some form of aggregator who would then be making the most of the flexibility that I have on my site. And maybe lots of terms there for people who may not be kind of so in the detail of this. So perhaps could we make it real? Could we say, well, like, what does an example customer look like for you? What type of, when we talk about flexibility, what do we mean?
There are many possibilities. So we focus on sort of larger commercial industrial customers. So, you know, we don't often go below a megawatt, but that's not the only viable business. There are certainly things you can do with domestic EV chargers, heat pumps, behind the meter batteries. But behind the meter, I guess, is a key phrase. This is not about a front of meter asset, something that's built specifically for energy market purposes. Yeah, battery would be a typical one. This is about finding things that the customer has that they're using to consume energy that they can do something slightly different with, which may have a cost, but there's more value to be had to justify that cost. To give an example, yesterday I was at a site of a customer of ours in Ireland. They have an air separation unit that makes lots of liquid nitrogen, oxygen, argon, various other things. And they provide flexibility for us in a couple of different ways there, one of which is by in Ireland's capacity market, which is essentially an energy market. They're tied together there. They will shut down for a couple of hours if we ask them to. That's a fairly manual process. They do a sort of gentle shutdown, takes a few minutes to do. They also provide frequency response, which is we will shut off, I think, 5 megawatts of compressor load within a couple of seconds and keep that up for 20 minutes. So that's, you know, an industrial process that exists. When we interrupt them, they incur some costs in doing that, but they're willing to do so if we're paying them enough. And if you look at it from the economics of the country, it's worthwhile doing that because there is more value from using the power that's available for other things than for their particular use at that particular time.
Yeah. No, it makes total sense, right? So if you can flex some of that demand, then you don't have to build that kind of final perhaps battery or perhaps transmission line at quite large cost that you don't necessarily use all year round. You can just use a little bit of flexibility from the demand side to be able to reduce the overall system cost. And I think just worth coming back to the in front of the meter and behind the meter piece, because I think that does confuse a lot of people. When someone says something's in front of a meter, that doesn't mean that it hasn't got a meter. It means that there's one meter for the particular asset. And so it's almost like a one-to-one relationship, but it is still behind a meter. But when people talk about behind the meter, they mean there is a meter and then there's a series of things that sit behind that meter. And some of those might be sub-metered, but everything sits behind the meter. It's just how the industry talks about in front of the meter and behind the meter.
That's exactly right. There tend to be lots of meters everywhere. The key point about behind the meter is that you're behind some supplier's meter. So there's someone else who's responsible for the normal supply to that site, which is not the case when you just build a grid scale battery. And that's what makes things a little bit challenging in terms of getting a settlement right. You have to make sure that the supplier isn't getting adversely affected by what you're doing. Mm-hmm. A kind of naive way of approaching it is saying, well, maybe you should negotiate with that supplier so you can square things up. But in practice, there's competitive tension between suppliers and aggregators, so that basically never works. And mm-hmm. In fact, the European rules say that you cannot require an agreement between these parties, which was not the initial approach, but they've landed there because that is the approach that works.
Okay. And let's come back to the kind of the how does the metering side work and how does the relationship with suppliers work. Let's just make sure that we've got kind of each of the key players identified in this. So we have the supplier, they have the meter, and they have been kind of the historic provider of, and in the future they will also be the provider of energy to that site. We have the consumer themselves with the flexibility that they have, and then this other party, and you mentioned kind of a virtual trading party, but we also hear sort of a virtual lead party or a VLP. What's the difference between those two things?
So both of those are independent aggregators. It's just the Balancing and Settlement Code loves to have unique terminology. So the virtual lead party is a concept that was brought in at the beginning of the sort of wider access to the balancing mechanism process. And that is someone who is also responsible for what happens in a particular, going through a particular meter aside from the supplier. So in Balancing and Settlement Code terms, a particular meter can be a member of a primary balancing mechanism unit, that's a supplier's unit, and also a secondary balancing mechanism unit, and that is the one which the virtual lead party controls. So this is about separating normal supply from flexibility.
Yes.
And essentially, most of the time, it's all down to the supplier and the primary balancing mechanism unit. Just thinking of the balancing mechanism, when you have a dispatch from the system operator in the balancing mechanism, at that point, for that period, the virtual lead party becomes responsible. So the secondary BMU becomes responsible for how the consumption on that site deviates from what they otherwise would have done.
Yes. Okay.
And I can see you going to your next question.
Yeah. So let's just pause there for a second, because I know that when we put out these videos, and particularly when we come into something that's kind of has a lot of new phrases and terminology like P415, that I think sometimes it can be really difficult to actually really work out kind of who the people are. So let's just turn a few of those names into your example for the manufacturing facility with say the gas compressors. And so you have your supplier who is typically providing energy to that site, and that is kind of the primary. And then you have the ability to flex up and down that particular compressor, and that would be managed by the virtual lead party. And really when that happens is when there's a need from the system for that to do something effectively, that's when the virtual lead party can make a decision. And then because that individual asset gets metered, how that moves up or down goes into their pot of kind of energy up or energy down. And so they can then get paid for it, and then they can kind of pass that on to the end consumer.
That's right. There are a couple of more details though. So you wouldn't necessarily have to put a separate meter on the compressor.
Okay.
You could just look at what the supplier's boundary meter is saying and say that we'll compare what actually happens with a counterfactual of what they would have consumed if we hadn't done anything. And for that particular site, it's really easy. They always consume, I think it's like 6 megawatts, mm-hmm. Unless they stop something. Mm-hmm. So it's quite easy to draw a line across 6 megawatts and say, well, we deviated from that.
Yes.
So that's what's called a baseline. The challenge is coming up with a baseline which is, you can be sure that it's sufficiently accurate, mm-hmm. and that no one's playing any games with it. In the history of demand response, there have been a few sort of classic examples of sports stadiums putting their lights on during the day and things like that in order to get to game their baseline.
So effectively with baselining, you're saying the person who's paying for the service really wants to make sure they're getting something valuable for it. And so in order to do that, they have to know what would you have done if I didn't pay you to do this? And so you're saying, well, some meters you can kind of look at and they always do the same thing, so it's pretty damn obvious. Yeah. But there are some other cases where there's a bit more flexibility. And so actually defining what that baseline is a bit more complicated. And so that's really what we're saying here. So the person paying for the service is saying, hey, prove it. Prove that you're doing the right thing at the right time.
Yes. And if you've got that number, that this is what would otherwise have happened, then you can also use that for settlement so that then from the supplier's perspective, you want them to not be adversely affected, but also not have a windfall gain from this action. So if you leave it so that it is as if the consumer had carried on consuming at the baseline, the supplier should be perfectly happy, have no cause for complaint. So that's something that the wider access reforms did a part of, in terms of they corrected the balancing position of the supplier to remove the effect of the activation. And P415 builds on that adding that same correction for wholesale market activations, but it also adds one extra element, which is financial compensation for the supplier. So the issue is that although the supplier doesn't end up out of balance under the sort of previous regime, they do have a legitimate complaint that let's say they were expecting that customer to consume 7 megawatt hours in that hour, but because of this action, they only consumed 2. They went and bought 7 megawatt hours. They only get to bill the customer for the 2 that the meter shows. The 5 megawatt hour difference, which is the demand response, gets taken away in a perimeter correction. So they're not left exposed to imbalance, but they do end up having bought something that they expected to sell and they never got to sell, and it got taken away. So it tries to fix that by saying, and we'll also pay you for that.
Yes. So just to talk through that, they're expecting to see 7 megawatt hours on the meter. They only see 2. An external party comes in and kind of chews up their meter, not with a screwdriver. That doesn't happen, but it gets done virtually. But in that circumstance, they're still expecting to provide 7 megawatt hours because they've bought that in the wholesale market. So they provide 2, but they've got 5 left over. What do they do with that 5?
That 5 gets effectively taken away by Elexon in the balancing and settlement process as what's called a perimeter correction. So that has to happen because otherwise the supplier would find themselves out of balance. They'd be long by 5 megawatt hours, and that would expose them to financial risk. In this case, there's no risk, but there's just the fact that they bought this stuff and it was taken away that needs to be compensated for.
And they've bought it, say, at £60 or £70 per megawatt hour. What do they get paid for it?
Well, they probably, they wouldn't have bought it recently because they were... they know they have this customer to supply who has a reasonably predictable load. They might have bought it a year ago, depending on their hedging strategy. So there's what you're really after is a kind of a long-term average sourcing cost, and that's what you'd like to compensate them at. It's quite hard to get that number. Different markets have used different ways of doing this. So if you look at the equivalent mechanism in Australia, they use a long-term average wholesale price, I think over about a year or something. France uses a blend of futures costs and wholesale costs. Again, a long-term average. What was settled on in P415 was, trying to avoid building something new. We just need a number for what does the supplier probably pay to source things? And the Ofgem price cap mechanism was a convenient source of such a number. So the number that's used is based on that.
Okay, so the supplier through the process ends up the kind of where they then get they get an exposure is they have that 5 megawatt hours that gets kind of taken off their books, but they have to kind of be compensated for it. So there might be some difference between what they paid for it and then what they got compensated for. But effectively,
it should be a second order.
It should be a small piece. Then the consumer themselves, that's quite a straightforward piece because they've agreed with you, a virtual lead party, to get paid for doing a thing. And so it costs them £10 to turn it down. They get paid £20 for it, so they're happy. Mm-hmm. And then from the aggregator side or the virtual lead party side, you are providing a service to that. You're providing service to the wider system, and mm-hmm. you're getting paid £40 for it, and you're passing on whatever £20 to just in a theoretical example.
Whatever the commercial deal is, yes. But so we are selling that energy on the wholesale market. So presumably we have done some kind of a wholesale trade to do that. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really matter what the details are. If we've got the volumes wrong, so we did a trade of one size and the customers actually delivered more or less than that, then we're exposed to imbalance just like any other resource.
And this feels to me like it all works. So each party kind of, it makes sense, which is good news. But where doesn't it work? What am I missing?
I mean, it's quite complicated.
Yes.
That's probably a downside. But there's one implementation issue that's may cause a problem here in GB, which is around the supplier compensation. So the way that I originally proposed it was that the compensation going to the supplier would be paid by the virtual lead party, by the aggregator, or by the virtual trading party, if we use the correct terminology for the rule.
For the sticklers, for the BFE sticklers, yeah.
And there are some.
Yeah, yeah.
That has some quite nice properties in you can say that you're giving the correct economic incentives to all the parties. But one way of looking at it is that is a cost for the aggregator and hence for the customer providing flexibility. So that does make customers less likely to participate or provide less volumes or at different prices than they would without that compensation payment. So what Ofgem decided was that they would have, instead of requiring the virtual lead party or the customer to pay their compensation, it would be socialized. So it's basically collected from a levy across all customers, which, you know, it should definitely mean that you get more enthusiastic demand reduction. My worry is that it kind of gives a cause for complaint. People can say, look, there's this subsidy cost here. Could be viewed as a subsidy. So that's one problem. It breaks symmetry in a way which I think is already leading to concerns. So we talked about doing demand reduction, so going from 7 megawatts to 5 megawatts, 7 megawatts to 2 megawatts. Let's say they could actually go from 7 megawatts to 8 megawatts, so a demand increase.
And so
that plant can't, but let's say it could.
But let's say it could, yes. And we're in a world where maybe we've got too much generation and we are thinking about having to do some really expensive things to use up that generation. So maybe there's a cheaper way of kind of turning up demand somewhere else.
Exactly. So from the economics perspective, you're saying, well, energy is really cheap right now. The wholesale price, is £1. It makes sense if the customer can get more than £1 worth of value out of that for them to consume more. And the idea is you should expose them to that somehow, despite the fact they're on a normal retail tariff with their supplier, where they might be paying £20. The problem is that the way things have currently been arranged, if they increase their demand by 1 megawatt hour, the aggregator can buy that energy for £1. That's great. But the customer still has to pay their supplier £20 for it. They will be billed for it as normal.
Well, why is there not in the same way? So in the inverse, you had that border adjustment. I think you described it as. In this way, why does a border adjustment not happen?
So it does happen, but it doesn't flow all the way around. So from the supplier's perspective, they expected to sell 7. They actually sold 8. They would have bought 7 at their normal procurement cost. Because there's a perimeter correction, if you didn't have a perimeter correction, they would end up short by 1 megawatt hour because the customer consumed 8 rather than 7 they bought. So the perimeter correction does happen. So they get gifted 1 megawatt hour of power. So they end up back in balance. And it's recognized that they get a windfall from this because they get gifted this energy and they get to sell it for £20. So they have to pay this reverse compensation of £20. But that doesn't actually reach the customer or the virtual lead party because of the socialization mechanism. It gets sort of put into the slush fund so it reduces the total cost of compensation for demand reduction or nets off against that, but it doesn't reach the party whose decision you're trying to influence, the customer. If you had the non-socialized approach, then it would reach them and everything would work out quite neatly. So that is a worry that it means that we'll have more demand reduction, which is the most obvious thing to look at.
But the demand increase in the world where we have too much generation and are oversupplied, we don't necessarily incentivize that as effectively.
Exactly. The price has to be negative for it to actually make sense for the customer to do that. There's a further twist on this. So one concern that many suppliers have is what they call the rebound effect. So, the example I gave of, shutting down this air separation, you're actually stopping, you're reducing their total annual production. They never catch up and consume more some other time. But quite a lot of demand response is not like that. is actually time shifting. You know, if you think of, say, an EV charger, then if you stop the customer from charging at some point, they're going to charge at some other point. Ideally, you should be optimizing where they charge it as well as when they don't charge it. The really neat way of doing that would be to treat both sides of that shift as separate dispatch events. So the aggregator says, don't charge now, and that's settled, either in the balancing mechanism or whatever service it is they're doing. It might be doing frequency response. Mm-hmm. And then as a consequence of that, you then need to do some more charging some other time. So you say, well, we'll have another event here where they're going to consume more than their baseline. Mm-hmm. That would work really neatly. But if you set up if the flows don't work for demand increase, then they will almost never work that you'll be able to do both of those profitably.
One half, the demand reduction is kind of accounted for well. And then the second half of it, which is, okay, I'm not charging my car at 7 o'clock, I'm charging it at 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. That's not really flowing through as well.
Correct.
Okay. I hope listeners will have a kind of good understanding of how P4 and 5 works and kind of how the processes work. Perhaps turning this into practice. So are we just talking about a single factory somewhere that has some flexibility? Are we talking about 1 megawatt, 10 megawatts, 1 gigawatt? How big is the impact of this on the market?
It's very hard to say. I mean, in terms of, it's not just factories. It should work for all scales of flexibility. You want to aggregate it to make it up to a useful volume where your trading charges are going to wipe everything out. But it is a missing piece. So kind of aesthetically, we want this part here so that all markets are accessible. The question is, looking at all of the value that could be had from flexibility, what proportion of it can only be had through the wholesale market? And I don't have a good answer for that. There's lots of consultancies that have done analysis, which tends to show that certainly the wholesale market is biggest. How much of it you can access from flexibility? It's actually very much like a battery optimization issue. Even with a front of beta battery, you can be in the providing frequency response services. You can do reserve. You can do capacity markets. You can do balancing mechanism, and you can do wholesale. And I think it's fair to say the trend is towards wholesale price arbitrage being the larger slice of the pie, and the expectation is it will go further that way. So for demand response, it's been a problem that part of the pie hasn't been accessible unless you're willing to be spot price exposed or have a really good supplier. We're trying to fix that, and it's probably important now, and it should definitely be very important in future.
And I suppose part of that is, as soon as you allow people to actually do this properly and you allow prices to pass through, you can really get a sense of kind of actually what the level of response is. Because until you've got a price, everything is a consultancy report on paper, and it's not kind of real until you kind of actually say, okay, this is the price, this is the mechanism that's now in place. Now we can go to market and see what turns up. Because let's say we talk about just a particular section of the market, and let's say it is just, we just look at factories. Will they choose to respond, or will they say, oh, actually, for the amount of money that's on the table here, I'm actually not going to go ahead and do it? So is it going to be 100 megawatts? Is it going to be 2 to 3 gigawatts? Will be really interesting to see. And now we have the mechanism in place, we should start to see that data coming through. If I follow your kind of your logic.
Yes.
Okay, I'm quite excited about kind of like how quickly that will come through. So now P4 and 5 is approved. When does it go live? When does it all happen?
It actually went live last week on the 7th of November. But going live means you can start the process of registering to become a virtual trading party. So in terms of actually having a customer impact of real megawatts doing things, that's going to be next year.
Okay. So something to kind of keep a lookout for, and on that kind of pathway of let's see the data coming through and then let's make decisions around kind of how much volume is out there. We should start to see volumes coming through as of next year. Okay, and maybe to make this kind of real for a consumer, let's say I have an EV or I have a home storage system, like a rule of thumb, or is there like an amount of money that someone might be able to get from this, or is it all very dependent on market conditions?
I think it's very dependent, and there are some unknowns. I mean, it's quite easy to take a mechanism that looks like it should work and make it not work. One thing that could not work here is operational metering. So, you know, if we were required to spend a lot of money per site in order to provide National Grid with high resolution, low latency data, then that sort of puts the minimum site size at which that becomes cost effective quite high. Hopefully that won't happen, but we're waiting for a review on that.
And so this is saying, for non-fans of meters, you're saying that some services require really high quality metering and really high quality accuracy of what's going on the site. And that comes through these operational meters. And so they can be quite expensive.
In general, metering is not that expensive. Yeah, you know, it can be built-in functionality in an EV charger or an inverter or whatever. But what is sort of inescapably expensive is providing low latency data to the national system operator.
Okay. And so I think, Paul, just to my last two questions, and the same questions for everyone. So the first question is there anything that you'd like to plug?
So something that's quite surprising about GB, you know, given the amount of noise that's made about how advanced we are with flexibility and so on compared to other markets, is that it's actually not mature here. There are some mature flexibility markets where, you know, looking at commercial industrial customers, everyone we talk to already knows about it or has tried it. But that's actually not the case here. So I think there are still a lot of commercial industrial customers out there who are not providing flexibility. Maybe they looked at it and thought there wasn't a value in it, or they just haven't heard about it, or only doing it in a fairly minimal way. They're not stacking together multiple services to optimize. So I guess the simple commercial plug is come and talk to NLX. We can probably help.
Okay, very good. And do you have a contrarian view? So something that you believe that the majority of the market doesn't?
It's possible that some of the market's caught up with me on this, but I guess there's been this key phrase in policymaking circles of technology neutrality. So the idea is you should always design products and markets to be technology neutral. You should just think about what do you need in the system. Don't think about any particular technology when you're doing it. Write the rules, and then that way, yeah, people will compete and you'll find the optimal mix of technologies to deliver it. And I agree entirely with that principle. But I think it's time to say that in practice, it hasn't been working. It's been subverted too many times. It's very easy when doing that to actually be thinking about gas generators or about front of meter batteries or about coal plants. Those are examples from GB, Italy, and Germany. And write your rules so that, yes, you can argue that, you know, at no point does it say you can't do this with demand side flexibility or you can't do this with the battery or whatever. But in practice, the tiny details mean that only the technology you were thinking of can do it. So what I hope is that there will be a shift towards sort of technology inclusiveness, this idea that, you know, you think about what the system needs, and then you go through all of the possible technologies and figure out how do I accommodate that to the extent it can help solve the problem. That hasn't really happened much yet, and I hope it will.
That's a lovely place to leave it. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Transmission, a Modo Energy podcast. Transmission delivers conversations from industry leaders and experts exploring energy markets and the operations and technologies related to grid-scale battery energy storage. Check out our other episodes by searching Transmission wherever you get your podcasts. Check out the Energy Academy, our video crash course on how markets in Great Britain and ERCOT work, or head to modoenergy.com to see our written research. Thanks for listening.